The Athletic.
Totally football show today. Packed like the entrance to the Suez. Punchy like the exit of the Suez. It's our Totally International Week special with thoughts on England. From waistcoat to waste generational fullback, does Gareth still turn us on? There's Norway's boycott bid. Wenger arsing about with the World Cup. Belgium, Wales, WCL quarterfinals, and the return of the Intertotally. It's all just about squeezing into this Totally Football show in association with Paddy Power. Thursday, 25th of March, and hello, listener. And yes, it is a party feeling here on the Totally Show today because it's international time. Woohoo! And we've got an exciting smorgasbord of treats to dip into with our guests, who are favourites. Tom Williams. Hello, Tom.
Hello, James.
Also with us, Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
And I'm delighted to say Duncan Alexander's here too. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Hello, Duncan. It's not just International Week that you're celebrating, is it? You've also got... Why don't you tell us?
Yes, we've launched a new website this morning, theanalyst.com. So it's kind of fan-facing, and the idea is remember all the stuff that you can find on your local neighbourhood up to Joe, but in a much bigger, more varied fashion, really. So a bit like how Fernando Torres was very good in the late 2000s and early 2010s, but now has bulked up to become an even wider available source of things. So, yeah, like that, really. So check it out.
Nice. Sexy start to the show, but statistical analysis website announcements. Opta, of course, also had a quiz this week, I believe, Coxie, and you were involved.
Yeah, it was. It was very well hosted, as always, by Duncan. Different to usual, of course, because it was virtually rather than in person. And we essentially competed as individuals rather than teams, which was disconcerting.
But, you won, I imagine.
I didn't. I came second behind a guy called Will Rickson, I think his name is Duncan, who I think works for Monday Night Football.
Damn. Yeah, he's like Jamie Carragher's right-hand man off screen. So it's
he's the
you know,
hand
no
up
disgrace.
Jamie Carragher, clearly.
Well... I mean, as Michael said, it was run individually for the first time, so it was quite good to see some familiar names popping in and out of the top five. But also, we've now amalgamated the scores, crunched the numbers.
Right.
And I can reveal, I mean, by the time the pod goes out, it will have been revealed, so this is less of a reveal than it could be. But the Athletic retained their title from last year.
In terms of the team conglomerate, you mentioned familiar names in the top five, Duncan. One unfamiliar name, but familiar to listeners, is producer Charlie, who was fourth. Wow. Tell us some of the big names that producer Charlie beat with his big brain.
Well, it was people from all over the football media industry. So he was up there. I mean, I saw Nick Miller's name pop in the top five. Daniel Story was up there for a bit. He claimed he had to answer the door to get an Amazon delivery, which impacted his score. But, I mean, I'm not sure Amazon delivered to Leicestershire, so I don't know if we can accept that.
Was Jack Lang featuring?
No, he's... He's got better things to do, I'm sure.
His knowledge is too esoteric, I think, okay. for quiz purposes.
Jack can't even remember where he's watched historical football games, so there's no chance he'd be any good on this quiz.
Wow. He was watching CCTV of five-a-side football on the Copacabana, so it's, you know.
Well, if it's quizzes you're after, we've got something pretty special ourselves a little bit later on, with, as mentioned, the return of the Intertotally Cup. And round one... What a lineup. Tom, it's you against reigning champion Michael. Any thoughts?
Yeah, tough draw. Not going to lie. Probably not the draw I would have picked. But at the same time, you know, the pressure's all on Michael. He is the defending champion. He's the one going in there with the big reputation. I've just got to go out there, play my natural, you know, quiz. And if I end up coming out on top, a little moment of history.
Well, indeed. Heavy hangs the crown, Michael.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Had good preparation with the traditional curtain raisers to the quiz season with the Opta quiz on Tuesday. So, yeah, looking forward to later on.
And in case you're wondering, listener, Michael does have one of those moving backgrounds behind him with various sponsors' names as he made that statement. Well, lots of that to come. Lots of international reaction. We've got WCL quarterfinals and more. But a salute first, though, to Frank Worthington, another famous name from the English game that left us this week. One of the sport's great mavericks, but as is often the case, his demise really a kind of chance to discover or rediscover for many the stories behind the name. For example, a lot of people absolutely stunned to witness that defining goal that he scored against Ipswich in probably his greatest season when he finished Golden Boot when he was playing for Bolton back in the late 70s.
Worthington now for Dowling Taylor and Worthington!
I'm surprised that there were people who hadn't seen it before. It's sort of one of the iconic goals of English football history. And I remember as a kid, my dad telling me about it. And this is obviously pre-YouTube. I remember him sort of telling me how, you know, the ball had kind of come out and Worthington sort of juggles it a couple of times on the edge of the box and then makes as if he's just going to hook the ball back into the area. So the defence, the Ipswich defence all push up, playing offside, but in fact he's just hit it over his own head to himself, volleys it bottom right. And I remember sort of like, you know, having this sort of mental image of the goal in my head, you know, as a kid, and then, you know, sort of saw the footage and it was every bit as good as it had been made out to be. Yeah, so it was nice to see that all over everyone's Twitter timelines the other day.
It was very much a sort of goal you'd see in a Roy of the Rovers in sort of the 1980s. Like it seemed improbable, like a player would think to do that. But I saw a miss by Kenny Dalglish at Old Trafford the other day, which I'd never seen before, from the 80s or late 70s. And it all comes about because, I can't remember the player who does it, but he does the same thing over the onrushing United defence, who all just sprint out for offside at an incredible pace and leave the entire... So if you timed it right, you've got the entire attacking half. So Liverpool have two versus the goalkeeper when they still manage to miss the chance. But that was a very 1980s thing, this kind of incredibly fast, almost stupid offside trap.
Well, didn't Ronald Koeman score a goal like that, either for Barcelona or for the Netherlands, where I think the ball comes to him sort of midway inside the opposition half. He chips it over the defence, who all rush out in sort of a slightly comical fashion. But then he charges through himself and then I think either chips the keeper or knocks it past him.
Mm-hmm. A lot of Frank Worthington's more celebrated exploits wouldn't have sat happily in the pages of Roy of the Rovers, described as a working-class George Best by his manager at Huddersfield Town and Bolton, Ian Greaves. Certainly a man who seemed to make the most of his time on earth and... we salute Frank Worthington. Well, let's talk now some midweek international action.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Mighty touch from Bale. Conor Roberts sits back with Gareth Bale, who puts in a beautiful ball and it's swept home. What a move that is. Finished off. Stroked home by Harry Wilson.
International weekend and there's been action already. Tom, your Wales has been in the thick of it. Belgium-Wales Wednesday night, and what an opening goal.
Yeah, absolutely sensational goal. As I remarked on Twitter, one of the best Wales goals I can ever remember. It was about 10 minutes in, playing on an awful pitch in Leuven in Belgium. A really greasy player slipping all over the place. And Wales, despite the fact they're playing on this terrible pitch against the number one ranked team in the world, managed to construct a 17-pass move involving all 10 outfield players, which culminates in Harry Wilson playing the ball forward to Gareth Bale. He flicks it out first time to Conor Roberts. Conor Roberts plays it back to Bale, and then Bale, spotting the sort of third-man run of Wilson into the box, steers it into his path. Harry Wilson opens his body, left foot, bottom left corner. Wales 1-0 up and running. And looking forward to another famous win over Belgium, who Wales have had a pretty decent record against of late, only to then get beaten 3-1.
3-1. A decent second half performance until that penalty rather undid you, the third goal. But watching Belgium, the number one ranked team of the world, but it's a bit an exercise in just going, oh, crikey, he's Belgian as well. And him too. Astonishing lineup, really. Until you get to the bench where Roberto Martinez pops up, another little surprise. It's an incredible lineup, though, isn't it? Where's the weak point in that Belgian team, Tom?
I mean, the defence is getting on a bit. Last night they played with a back three of Alderweireld, Thomas Vermaelen, which sort of took me back a bit, and Jan Vertonghen. There's not a huge amount of pace in that back line. They brought Jason Denayer on, the Lyon centre back, in second half. He always looks pretty solid for Lyon and quite shaky for Belgium. And as you say, Wales made a really good start to the second half. Looked like they were, you know, really in the game, and then gave away an avoidable penalty that Lukaku tucked away. But yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. You look at that Belgium team on paper, and you fully understand why they're the number one ranked team in the world. They've not lost a home qualifying match since 2010 or something. And I think they feel more than they feel closer to the sum of their collective parts than previous Belgium teams we've seen. Obviously, go back to the famous Euro 2016 quarterfinal when Wales knocked Belgium out, and that was, you know, that was seen as a huge disappointment for that team, because it's pretty much the same players they have now, but they do seem to have kicked on since then. Obviously, the next objective for them for this, you know, sort of once in a generation group of players is to win a big tournament.
Mm. Sorry, that's Belgium you're talking about, not Wales.
Yeah, sorry, I should specify Belgium.
Right, but despite the 3-1 defeat, you're left feeling quietly positive, I imagine, are you, about Robert Page's side?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few things that were sort of uncommon from a Wales perspective. They didn't look after the ball all that well, which is usually something Wales always do, and this sort of goes back to, you know, Chris Coleman's tenure, even before that, you know, Gary Speed's tenure. Wales have been a really good passing team for the last few years now. And whether it was the pitch, whether it was because, you know, they were sort of missing key players. Joe Allen made his return after a long absence and ended up limping off after about 8 to 9 minutes, which was a blow. They're a little bit shaky in possession. But yeah, apart from that, you know, they had a good go. They made chances. And it's the toughest game of the qualifying campaign. It's already out of the way. That the one slight worry now is that Czech Republic, who Wales play next week, won 6-2 against Estonia. Thomas Suchek hat-trick. So they're looking pretty good. And you know, that is basically what the group is going to come down to. I don't think anyone's going to stop Belgium from winning it. So it is going to be a battle between Wales and the Czechs to see who can finish second.
Brilliant. All right. Meantime, at the Welsh training camp, of course, Gareth Bale causing confusion and uproar with his comments about basically going back to Spurs for a quick training camp, essentially, and that he will be returning to Madrid, thank you very much, at the end of the season. Scam Allardyce tweeting, Gareth Bale hit up Tottenham at 3 a.m. asking you up, and they answered. What a life. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, you sort of wonder how that little snippet of the interview went down in Madrid, because I can't imagine anyone in Madrid is too excited at the thought of Bale returning to the club for next season. It put me in mind of that. I'm trying to think who it is. It's like a GIF or like a little video you occasionally see of some American sports person trying to get into a training facility that they've been locked out of, and they're there sort of like just kind of pulling on the door. And I sort of wonder whether that's
Tom.
What awaits Bale when he
does
when
anybody
he goes
know
back
which
to Madrid?
GIF or GIF that Tom
no,
is referring to?
Tom seems to be football Twitter's leading expert on GIFs these days. So
I do enjoy a GIF. It's, I mean, someone will know it. It's probably some world famous basketball player. There we go. Yeah.
What happens? He's trying to get in, can't get in.
It's not a GIF. It's a little video clip, and I think he maybe interviewed. He's like, oh, you know, can't wait to, you know, get back in training with the boys, and then he is shown arriving at the door of the training complex, and it's been locked because they don't want him to come in, and he's
you're kidding
standing there, sort of like tugging on the door handle.
Crikey! Anyway,
we've all been there.
Mm. Other scores from around the Wednesday night action: Republic of Ireland scored a goal and took the lead in their game away at Serbia. They ended up losing 3-2. A brace from Alex Mitrovic, first goal of which the chip is pretty special.
Oh, absolute beauty.
He's now Serbia's joint top scorer. World champions France fielded an all-star lineup but got held 1-1 by Ukraine. Griezmann with a lovely curler for the opener. Ukraine then jammily deflecting one in off Kimpembe. Elsewhere, as Tom mentioned, Thomas Suchek got a hat-trick as Czech Republic did Estonia 6-2. And a hat-trick as well for Burak Yilmaz at the age of 35. That was in Turkey's 4-2 defeat of the Netherlands. And yes, Yilmaz is now the oldest European player to score a hat-trick in World Cup or Euro qualifying history. Woof.
Bad result, that, for the old Dutch. And not a sensation to reveal that. But, you know, they didn't qualify for the last World Cup, and they only let in 12 goals in that campaign, so they've already conceded a third of that in one game. So they do have a particularly on-off relationship with qualifying for the World Cup, Holland. Obviously, you know, got to the semis in 2014 and then didn't qualify for 2018. So you'd expect them to bounce back this time, but that's not a good start.
And did the same thing, go to the semis in 98 and didn't qualify for 2002 as well. I thought they were quite unlucky in this game, actually. I watched this one and, I mean, they had missed penalty, shot hit the post. Turkey's opener was against a run of play. Netherlands has started quite well. So I wouldn't read too much into the result. But this is shaping up to be maybe the most interesting group in the European section.
Well, also in that group are Norway, who we'll be talking about very, very shortly, and also Montenegro, Latvia and Gibraltar. So all is not yet lost for Netherlands, but not a great start.
Just a word on Yilmaz. He joined Lille last summer at the age of 35. He'd only ever played in Turkey, except for one season in China. And I mean, he's got a great scoring record for Turkey. He had a very good scoring record in his last few seasons playing in Turkey. But I did wonder how well he'd fare in Ligue 1, which is quite a physical league. Lots of young, very quick defenders. And he's been brilliant. I can't think of many players who I've enjoyed watching as much as him this season. Not particularly quick, but so adroit technically. Always seems to make the right choices. Strikes the ball beautifully. And has been a really important factor in Lille's title charge this season.
Okay. Turkey have a big game coming up in the next few days, which we'll be discussing shortly. Tom, though, since you're on, just to clarify something, last Thursday we had a bit of a discussion within a debate about which player had the strongest weaker foot, about the phrase chocolate foot. Could you just clarify what that means for Dutch folk?
Chocoladebeen. It is a player's weaker foot.
Right.
So in Robin van Persie's case, it would be his right foot. In Arjen Robben's case, of course, it would also be his right foot. And yeah, just a really nice little turn of phrase to describe a player's weaker foot. I guess we describe it as, you know, the foot you use for getting on the bus or whatever.
Right.
And I don't know of any other...
What do we? I've never heard that one.
No, just not.
I've heard people say standing leg.
I've damaged my shoe. Which one? The one I used to get on the bus? Your left.
I'm sure I've heard. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I've just invented that.
While trying to get into the training ground that's been locked against me.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, I don't know of any equivalent phrases in the sort of global football lexicon.
But chocolate leg, is it for anyone's weaker foot, or does it have to be a particular kind of weaker foot? Is it a sort of completely useless weaker foot? Is it a kind of lamella weaker foot?
I mean, it's just your weaker foot, and you'd only use it in like a football
Can you have
context.
Two chocolate feet?
I mean, you could probably say that as like a, right. as a joke.
What about if you're actually made out of chocolate? What do you do then?
Anyway, we laugh about it, but the World Cup in Qatar is a very real challenge, and one actually that's been highlighted this week. And I'm amazed that I'm making the segue. But next up, we are going to be talking about Norway, who began their road to the World Cup in Qatar on Wednesday night against Gibraltar. This is after calls from within the Norwegian football community for the national side to actually boycott the Qatar World Cup in protest at the ongoing exploitation of migrant workers there. How serious a proposal was this? And what happens next? Let's find out from football consultant and wearer of many footballing hats, Tor Christian Carlsen. Tor, hello. Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, this call for the Norway side to boycott the Qatar World Cup, how serious was it? How much support did it get in Norway?
Pretty amazingly high, I would say, considering that it started off like a grassroots movement, if you like. It was Tromsø that first came out and took a stand against it as a club, and then five or six other top league clubs followed suit. But I think what we need to keep in mind is that this is mainly driven by activist supporters, if you like. And I'm not saying that in derogatory terms. But the way Norwegian clubs are structured is that they are members' clubs, and the members are able to raise kind of motions at the AGMs. And that's what happened in these cases. So clubs during the AGMs were kind of forced to to take the supporters' opinion into consideration, and that led to club after club supporting the boycott.
Right. And you can understand why the call for a boycott on moral and ethical grounds, and the statement from, I think, Tromsø originally talking about the corruption of modern slavery involved in Qatar's bid, which has seen, estimates are, 6,500 migrant worker deaths in a decade, which is close to two a day, which is extraordinary. Was the hope that other countries might show support? And after the Norwegian FA decided that, no, they would be playing Wednesday's game against Gibraltar, but wearing special T-shirts, what's the future now? Is there a hope that this is somehow going to snowball beyond Norway still?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's still not clear what position the Norwegian FA will take on this. Obviously, up to now, they are very much in favor of alternative measures. There is the stance that, by being in the competition and by qualifying to the World Cup, Norway can take use their entry to the World Cup to affect things in Qatar and improve the situation there. But what happened now, I think the crucial point was the general meeting of the FA, which was, I think, about 10, 14 days ago. This particular initiative to boycott Qatar didn't end up on the agenda, which was more of a bureaucratical reason for that, because it wasn't raised within the deadline. But there will be an extraordinary general assembly in the autumn, in which this particular situation will be on the agenda. And there was a poll in, I think, Norway's number one newspaper, VG, two or three days ago, which said that I think close to 70% of people were backing the boycott.
That's remarkable. I wonder how that would translate to other countries as well, because it does feel like the kind of thing a lot of people would get behind if they felt that there were a lot of institutions involved. But the FA, the Norwegian FA's statement, I think, was talking about fears that a cancellation of the World Cup would lead to acute unemployment among hundreds of thousands of workers. I don't know how much people would back that stance. But the notion of using participation as a way of shining a light on the repressive aspects of Qatar's regime and the practices that have been going on there. How much of FIFA do you think going to allow of that kind of thing? Has there been any reaction to the Norway T-shirts about human rights on and off the pitch that were worn on Wednesday night?
No, not really. I think the message was quite, carefully written, obviously. I think we would look silly if we'd been thrown out for mixing football and politics at this stage by sporting really really strong messages on those T-shirts. So obviously there is a line there that you don't want to cross. But I think you touched on it earlier. I think the key for this kind of movement to gather pace is to get other countries on board. And obviously we don't know what is being done at the behind the scenes diplomatic level. And usually, there is a hierarchy here, and generally the Nordic countries have tended to stick together in these matters. And so far, Denmark have, some Danish clubs have kind of joined this, but there isn't a kind of a unified Nordic movement as such. And then obviously there's UEFA. Another thing that I think has kind of halted the whole movement is the fact that we don't know the repercussions. So if Norway were to boycott Qatar 2022, then what would be the repercussions financially, as well as for the right holders and for football beyond the men's game? Mm. So would Norway be barred from youth competition, from the women's competition? So I think those are things that you really need to understand before voting on this matter.
Yeah, which is why you would need as many nations involved as possible. It'll be interesting to see whether we're talking about a boycott or just in terms of messages, etc., what impact Wednesday night's game and this whole story has in among supporters in other countries. But Tor, thank you so much for talking us through that.
Pleasure, James.
Tor Christian Carlson there. It's a difficult one because I think if you ask most football people, much as they love the World Cup, perhaps beyond any other footballing entity, not many people would feel happy with the way the World Cup ended up in Qatar or the way that things have been handled or the kind of government that they are. I mean, if, for example, say, 30 years ago, the World Cup had been given to apartheid South Africa, I don't think anyone would have found it fanciful to suggest nations shouldn't have gone. And in many ways, there is that kind of regime operating in Qatar, he said, getting a bit political. It's a tough one. And yet here we all are talking about the World Cup qualifiers.
No, I completely agree. I don't think most people disagree with anything that you've said there, James. I almost feel like the unusual nature of the football calendar in the last year or so has meant we've almost forgotten about it. We're almost just delighted that World Cup qualifiers and World Cup qualification can happen in any form. You know, there have been some question marks about whether this should have been a round of World Cup qualifiers. So I agree, we've almost got sidetracked and maybe gone away from the bigger issue of Qatar. And fair play to Norway for putting it back on the agenda.
Absolutely. It's a bit virtual at the moment. It's World Cup qualifiers. But when we get to Qatar as the actual host, it'll be an entirely different situation. Tom?
Yeah, I mean, there is just an acceptance, isn't there, that this World Cup will be played in Qatar, even though the voting process was questionable, should we say, even though this is a country...
I think demonstrably corrupt now, isn't it?
Well, there we go. And, you know, being played in a country with an appalling human rights record, and no one should feel good about that. But that is increasingly the way of modern football. You know, we embrace states with vast wealth because they pour money into our sport and they put on, you know, glitzy tournaments and they sponsor teams and they fund clubs and all the rest of it and it does leave a sour taste and I think it's commendable that Norway have taken this step and are prepared to be, you know, the ones who sort of stick their head above the parapet first. You would hope that that would be joined by other football associations and other nations, but at the same time, you know, the chances of this tournament being taken off Qatar are pretty much non-existent, I would have thought. So is it too late to affect any meaningful change? Possibly, but at least it's a sign that football isn't hasn't entirely got to the point where it's prepared to abandon all its principles just because a country like Qatar has put enough money on the table to host a tournament.
No, very, very fair point. I think whether or not it takes place, and it will take place in Qatar, it doesn't mean that gestures like this can't have some impact in terms of bringing change about. And I guess that would be the hope of the Norwegian FA with the gestures they've already got in mind. Well, Duncan?
Well, also, it's particularly powerful from Norway because they've waited a long time to have a team and a squad as good as this. You know, if they'd have done it 10 or so years ago, it could have been seen as a bit of an empty gesture if they were going to come fourth or fifth in their group. But, you know, you look at their team now and it's like, with that Turkey result, you could see them easily finishing top of the group now with the Netherlands having dropped points. So, you know, that just kind of only, you know, enhances what they did.
Norway getting their campaign underway on Wednesday with a 3-0 win over Gibraltar, and their next clash is against Turkey. We'll be discussing that a little bit later on. But speaking of World Cup controversy, slightly smaller one, which came out this week, as Arsene Wenger unveiled his World Cup every 2 years proposals with Christmas at weekends. This brought widespread horror, but let's hear him out, shall we?
Kick out of the parallel competitions out of the game. People must understand what is at stake and only have games with meaning. If you look at the teams in the World Cup, usually the average age is 27 or 28. Because the World Cup is every 4 years, there are very few chances to win it again because when they go back to the next World Cup, they're 32 or 33. That's why maybe we should organise the World Cup every 2 years. Huh.
Now, to make this happen...
How did you get him on the show? That's amazing. What a coup.
Thanks, Arsene. To make this happen, Arsene suggests concentrating all the qualifiers into 1 month or perhaps two quadruples in October. I'm not sure what that means, but basically a chunk in October and February, reducing the amount of international breaks thus needed during the season and scrapping the Nations League to make room for the move, which is a shame because they've only just made all the merchandise and stuff. I actually quite like this idea. The business of the age, it's true. You know, the age of players.
I mean, it would have helped Gazza, wouldn't it? It's a pro Gazza move because he obviously only got to play in one World Cup. And if you'd have said that to someone in July 1990, they'd have cried more than Gazza, probably.
But so. He didn't get to the 94 World Cup, not because they waited till 94, but because England didn't qualify.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. But if you don't qualify for a World Cup, you're going to miss 8 years of your career, by which point you'll have annoyed Glenn Hoddle and he'd have been playing soft jazz as he doesn't get you in the squad. So,
yeah.
I feel like Arsene Wenger just reminds you of like recently retired dads who have got loads of time on their hands and lots of nervous energy. And if he was, you know, a suburban dad, he would have converted his garden shed into a little one-man pub or something and it would have been slightly tragic.
But now he's doing the World Cup.
Well, this is it, and he just keeps coming out with ideas. And I know it's his job to come out with ideas and proposals to improve the game.
Called him a suburban retired dad. Some respect on the name. imagine if, just say for the sake of argument, imagine if back in the day they had only got all the teams together in this country once every 4 years to decide who was best because, you know, logistics and that. And then someone said, some retired dad in suburbia somewhere said, why don't we do a title race every year? Would people have said, no, you can't do that, it'll make it less special or something? No, they'd have gone, yeah, let's go for it.
I'm not against progress. I just want to put that out there. Just not particularly in favour of this specific proposal of progress.
I'd say, okay, let's do it if they reduce the size of the World Cup again, because it's ever more increasing right. in size. And that just, you know, I'm not particularly looking forward to 2026 when it's groups of three, about 4,000 groups of three. So if it was every 2 years, but they went back to, let's say, a 32-team model, I think that would be okay.
Okay. Arsene, there you go. Michael?
Yeah, it's not a great idea. I agree with Duncan. I think the format of a lot of international competitions is causing a real problem at the moment. The Copa America, the upcoming format, is the worst I've ever seen in the history of association football.
Is it a Swiss league?
It's not. It's even worse than that. It's two groups of five, and then the top four from each group go through, which is just like...
The jeopardy.
Jeopardy. What is the what on earth is the point in that? That's just... I will not be watching any of the group stage. Knockouts might be fun. But taking... I mean, how many games is that to eliminate two sides? Complete waste of time. There's stuff like that that I think is could actually be a bit of a threat to the popularity of international football because you do end up with... so many meaningless games. And the whole joy of the World Cup was traditionally that every game counted. You know, every game was really, really important. And I think that has been lost a little bit.
Yeah, if we think back to the last World Cup, the group stage was actually quite good for once. But I think that was mainly down to VAR coming in and giving loads of penalties and stuff in every game, which increased the number of goals a lot. And you do get these little points in World Cup history. So after 1990, which was so defensive, they brought in the back pass rule in 1992. And the 94 World Cup was generally seen as one of the most entertaining. You know, the group stages were really good.
What, 94?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, I think they were good. I think the group stages were pretty good.
Oh, better than 1990 anyway.
Well, yeah, everything was better than 1990.
Well, yeah. But you do get these kind of... It gets to a point where they go, oh, no, we really are messing up the formula a bit here, and they kind of change it, and then everyone's like, yeah, World Cup's good again, and then they change it again.
Well, it's like you look at the Euro 2012, which was the last one with only 16 teams, I think I'm right in saying, four groups, and there were some fantastic groups, and every game had a sense of jeopardy because they were, you know, the 16 best teams on the continent, you know, or thereabouts, and a defeat in a group stage game felt like it could very easily be fatal. But then Euro 2016, the expanded tournament, you had to try quite hard not to qualify from the groups. And you had this very unsatisfactory unsatisfying, you know, qualification system where, you know, whereby it wasn't just the top
Wales
two from each group go through. And it sort of ruined it. Wales would have gone through even under the old
Portugal didn't win a group game, did they?
Well, yeah, yeah.
Which is,
but Italy didn't win a group game at the 82 World Cup and they still were world champions. Anyway, I think the lesson that Arsenal will draw from this is that World Cup reform, yes, but make tournaments smaller, not more often.
Mm. Yeah, snappy.
Well, wasn't World Cup 1982 essentially the same issue? Because it was a 24-team tournament, wasn't it? So it's basically it's the same argument, really.
Okay, so much for that.
No on 24 teams.
Next up, let's talk England and the games that everyone's looking forward to this weekend and whether those are the same thing.
At Paddy Power, we know competition for the remote control can be fierce at the weekends. So, in order to give the non-football-loving occupants of your house something to do, here are some of our top suggestions. Go for a walk. Walk the dog. Walk to the shops. Go cycling. Cycle the dog. Recycle the dog. Just go! All very good options, we say. And that's not the only one. If one leg of your 4+-fold acca lets you down, get a free bet on all football leagues and all markets. Paddy Power. Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg, online exclusive, exclude shop bets, T's and C's apply, 18 plus, begambleaware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Duncan, you want to talk about Portugal before we get on to the stuff coming up, because Portugal played and they won 1-0, but you weren't impressed, Duncan.
Well, Portugal struggled a lot in the game. Azerbaijan came back in the second half and could have equalised, but it was also amusing to see that Portugal's goal was an own goal. A cross came in and the keeper punched it into the back defender and it went in. But if the ball had passed those players, Ronaldo would have had a tap in. And I've never seen someone look more annoyed at his own team scoring a goal, because it, you know, and what's an own goal to his ever burgeoning...
Well, hang on. Surely he can't have looked as annoyed as he did when Nani deprived him from scoring one of the great solo goals in that friendly against Spain.
Yeah, but that wasn't disallowed. It wasn't a goal.
Oh yeah, sorry. Good point.
I'd say maybe the levels were sort of Frank Lampard when he scored against Chelsea for Manchester City in the Premier League. It was that sort of like, what are goals?
That's the only celebration in history that has directly led to a player getting a managerial job, I think. If he'd celebrated that goal, he would never have got the Chelsea job. But he was so mortified to score against Chelsea that he had to be appointed as manager one day.
He just gets it.
Yeah. Now, we heard that Wales began their campaign with defeat at the hands of Belgium. Northern Ireland will be beginning the road to Qatar Thursday evening against Italy. Austria will be the opponents for Scotland. And England get their campaign underway against San Marino, which gives us a chance to replay this all-time classic moment.
Against Holland. I'm sure you're aware now of what's at stake. And Bacciocchi, number 9, picks the ball up straight away, and San Marino launched the first attack. Oh, and a mistake by Stuart Pearce, and San Marino have scored. I don't believe this.
Wow, there it was, 1993. England won the 7-1 and missed out on the World Cup because Holland won anyway. Michael, where were you when San Marino scored after 8 seconds?
I don't know. I'd never watched a football match by that stage. I was
oh, really?
About
okay.
six. So...
Really?
Can't give you that one, I'm afraid.
But that was such a huge game. I thought everybody, you know, even 6-year-olds would have been clustered round the
Bakelite. Well, none of my family like football, so.
Really?
Can't tell you where it was, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, I know where you'll be this weekend when England
You know what? I won't be on my sofa watching it.
Really? Well, England actually playing, may well have indeed played the San Marino by the time you hear this, actually, listeners. That's Thursday evening. And then after that, perhaps more arduously for Gareth Southgate's side, it's Albania, a trip to Tirana with its scenic boulevards and statue of Norman Wisdom. What did you make of Gareth's squad for these three games? No big names left out or anything, was there?
Well, the Alexander-Arnold absence is obviously a huge story. I mean, there's an argument that he's the the most revered right back in Europe. And yet there's a very good chance that he won't be going to the tournament. I think Southgate has clearly picked on the strength of past England performances. A lot of the headlines were about, you know, he'd said Alexander-Arnold's form has dipped at club level, which is true, although it was dipping from a very high level. But really, if you look at the quotes, Southgate went to a lot more depth about past performances for England. And I think reality is he's never really looked comfortable for England. I don't know whether there's any reason for that. He hasn't been played out of position, really. He's been fielded where he'd want to be fielded. But, you know, Kieran Trippier has always done very well for England. Cole Walker's in there because he can play right-sided centre-back, and it looks like England will play with a three-man defence. And then if you go back to the last international break, which I think most people don't really remember because there's been so much football this year and, you know, international breaks in November can get forgotten by March. But Alexander-Arnold didn't have a good game for England, and he was replaced by Reece James for the next game. And Reece James was England's man of the match against Denmark. So, you know, it's been about past performance. And personally, I don't agree with the decision. I think you would always think a player of that calibre should be in the squad and able to get another chance. But I do welcome the fact that an England manager is picking on the strength of past England performances rather than just constantly hoping players will replicate their club form at international level when evidence doesn't suggest that, which I think is where England have gone wrong quite a lot in the past, particularly under the Ericsson era.
And the other story with England this weekend is obviously with Jordan Pickford not in the squad. This is a real chance, I think, for one of the goalkeepers, I mean, probably Dean Henderson, you'd think, to stake his claim to be England's first-choice keeper. You know, if Henderson keeps his place in the United team for the rest of the season, I'm pretty sure he'll be England's goalie for the Euros. You know, the only doubt people had about him before this season was whether he could pass the ball like a modern keeper should. Obviously, having been at Sheffield United last season, only took, I think, one goal kick in their own penalty area. But he's adapted very well with United, so there's no issues there.
You mentioned Norman Wisdom, and speaking of British comedians popping up unexpectedly in Eastern Europe, I was in Podgorica a few years ago to cover an England qualifying match against Montenegro. I was staying in a hotel, and there was a bloke working there, probably a few years older than me, who didn't speak a word of English, and I kept sort of bumping into him at a hotel. I think he might have sort of carried my suitcase to my room and served me breakfast one day, and, you know, we'd sort of smile at each other and then, you know, go our separate ways. And I think the second day that I was there, we walked past each other in the lobby and sort of smiled. And then when he was about 6 feet away from me, he just goes, "Rodney, you plonker." And it was one of the most perfect and also incongruous Del Boy impersonations you've ever heard. And he sort of smiled, and I looked at him quizzically, and then, went on my way. And it turns out that Only Fools and Horses is massively popular in Montenegro. And there is an Only Fools and Horses theme pub called the Nag's Head in Podgorica, which sadly I didn't have time to check out. But if anyone's passing through the Montenegrin capital at any point, probably worth going to have a look.
But why did he do that at you? Because you're English?
Because he knew I was British, I guess. And he was perhaps frustrated by his inability to communicate with me in any way.
Right. And the universal language of Only Fools and Horses.
The universal language of Only Fools and Horses. Also, you know, when am I going to get an opportunity again to dust off my Del Boy impersonation?
Right. Tom, you brought some refreshingly different content today, I have to say.
Thanks. That's the sort of vibe I aim for.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway, so that's what England are up to. The Albania game is coming up this week. And then I think, is it Poland, the third of the triumvirate?
Yeah.
We'll review how things go, certainly against San Marino and Albania in Monday's show. But what else from this weekend are you guys going to be watching out for? Tom?
Kazakhstan against France on Sunday afternoon. So France trying to make up for the fact they dropped points against Ukraine in their opener. France obviously favourites, but Kazakhstan are the team who thrashed Scotland 3-0 at the start of qualifiers for the Euro in the game that put pay to Alex McLeish as Scotland manager for the second time. They were also a minute away from getting a goalless draw away to Russia during that campaign. They play on a synthetic pitch, which France are a little bit worried about, and Didier Deschamps has pledged to rotate his starting 11 because they then play Bosnia in their third game, which is another tricky tricky one. And the expectation was that France would beat Ukraine in their opener and then they could then rotate against Kazakhstan without having to worry too much. But now there is much more pressure on France to get a result here, and a few players who could come into the France team having been recalled to the squad after periods on the sidelines. Tanguy Ndombele is back in, having now finally won Jose Mourinho's trust at Spurs. Ousmane Dembele as well, Thomas Lemar. So it could be a bit of a throwback France team lining up in this one.
It's a shame if they do rotate, because it was an exciting lineup that Deschamps went, surprisingly so, against Ukraine, with two strikers and Mbappe on one side and Coman on the other.
Yeah, I mean, Deschamps used France's games in the autumn in quite an interesting way, I thought, in that France won the last World Cup with this sort of asymmetric 4-2-3-1 with Blaise Matuidi as a kind of hard-working left-sided midfielder, counterbalancing Mbappe on the right. But you know, their football wasn't particularly great, and it hasn't been, you know, ever since. So Deschamps used those games in the autumn to test out different systems. And neither of those systems, although some of them look quite good on paper, were particularly convincing. So when France played Portugal in their sort of key Nations League game in November, they went back to the asymmetric 4-2-3-1 from the World Cup, this time with Adrian Rabiot on the left-hand side, Blaise Matuidi having sort of effectively retired from international football and moving to Miami. And yeah, I think people expected that that was the sort of team that he would pick to play Ukraine, but he went with Mbappe and Coman on the wings, and Giroud and Griezmann up front, which is about as attacking a France team as I think Deschamps has ever picked. But sadly, given that, you know, that France underperformed, you know, failed to get a victory, it might be a while before he permits himself to pick such an ambitious starting 11.
All right, Michael. Meantime, you're intrigued by Norway against Turkey, given how that group's begun.
Yeah. That was a game I picked out at the beginning, but to be honest, we've covered Norway quite well and we've all covered Turkey quite well, so well, I won't say anything more, but I think that's exciting.
One thing we haven't mentioned on Norway was that Christian Tortsvedt scored a goal for them, his first international goal, obviously son of totally listener Eric and former Tottenham goalkeeper. I don't know if 1990s goalkeepers have a WhatsApp group that descends into aggression, but Mark Poom's son was playing for Estonia as well this week, so he didn't score. But it's interesting that both sons chose to become midfielders, which is like, you know, I'm a creative player, you're a goalkeeper. So
yeah, evolution.
It's always the way, isn't it?
What about you, Duncan? What's ringed in red in your international football diary?
Well, international football can sometimes lack a few storylines, especially in qualifier stage. So people will probably be aware of the unofficial world champion. So, you know, Scotland won it off England back in the 19th century, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, as it stands, it's Italy at the moment.
Is it?
Yeah. But they obviously play Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland haven't been the unofficial world champions, in inverted commas, since October the 14th, 1933, which geopolitics fans might remember was the day Germany withdrew from the League of Nations, which kind of foreshadowed them finishing bottom of the Nations League. But they didn't get removed from that because UEFA changed the rules. So that makes you think.
Right, interesting. By the way, if you're after some statistical breakdown and analysis of why the Azzurri are currently on, I think, the longest unbeaten run of any European nation, over 2 years now, 18 matches under Roberto Mancini, which is quite a turnaround from the abject shower they'd become under Gianpiero Ventura before that, then you can find it where, Duncan?
On theanalyst.com, there's a big feature on how Mancini has revamped the Italy team.
I read it. It's got lots of big pictures as well. Speaking of Italy, a surprising and saddening announcement on Tuesday from Florence, with Cesare Prandelli, former Italy manager, stepping down as the manager of Fiorentina and publishing a letter in which he cites dark moments and what he calls a period of profound distress that has prevented him being who he really is. He says, I didn't want the dark clouds inside me to affect the team. And thus he's essentially saying goodbye to the profession. Really, well, a brave decision, but a really brave letter as well from a man who's been through a lot in his career. Michael, I know you're a big fan of Cesare Prandelli.
Yeah, I've really liked his teams over the years, as Parma with, was it Muto and Adriano, I think, he had up front, and then worked wonders with Fiorentina. And obviously, I think with Italy, you know, he was quite brave with them, slightly changed the style of play. Euro 2012, I think, went pretty well. But he's always been a guy who I think sees a life beyond football, hasn't he? I mean, you know, when he got that Roma job in 2004, I think it was, and resigned straight away because his wife was very ill. And I think a lot of people took that for granted. I think there's a lot of people in football who would have continued and would have put their profession first and would have kept on with that job he just signed up to do. But yeah, he just always struck me as basically a nice guy. And sorry to see him go, but it sounds like it's right for him.
Yeah, well, and hopefully it is a positive step for him, and probably something that will help other people as well, to have somebody who's been so successful, so high profile, come out and say that these are the issues that I've been facing, and you know, they exist, and it's something that we can talk about. Of course, this was his second spell at Fiorentina. He'd been wonderfully successful there back in the kind of late noughties, but picked up the reins last November of this season from Beppe Iacchini, who the club had, I would say, fired, but in Italy, everyone stays on contract. And in fact, it is Iacchini who will come back in and manage the club until the end of the season, when there'll be further changes. Anyway, all the best to Cesare Prandelli. Next up, we're going to hear about the WCL quarterfinals first legs, and also this.
Keep listening for Michael Cox versus Tom Williams in the Paddy Power Intertotally Cup. And it's live-ish.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Now, sign up for a subscription with The Athletic for unrivaled coverage on the business end of the season. It is only £4 a month, for which you get all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with all the Athletic's writers. Head to theathletic.com/totally. Women's Champions League quarterfinals began this week. Chelsea and Man City involved. Also Euro giants like Barcelona and Lyon. In what has been a whopping week for the women's game, certainly in Britain, with the announcement of a brand new and vast monster size TV deal. Joining us now is the Athletic's Katie Wyatt. Katie, thank you so much for joining us on this week of weeks.
Yeah, it's a really, really massive week for women's football. It started on Monday with the announcement of the new broadcast deal, which is 3 years of $7 million a year. So it works out about 20, obviously works out 21, I don't know why I said it works out about $21 million, as if we don't know the seven times table. But yeah, that's a huge investment for women's football that I think all different clubs will use differently. I think that you'll have some clubs that it means that they can really start to pay bumper wages, and there'll be other clubs that they can overhaul their facilities or invest in more backroom staff, and there'll be others for whom it means that they're just able to survive and have a little bit more independence from men's clubs if they've not been funded properly. So that's going to have a huge impact on clubs financially, and also in terms of how many people view the game, how popular it is, how visible it is, the type of coverage that's going to be available. So that's a mammoth thing in itself. That's a huge, going to be a huge step forward for the game in putting a price on its broadcasting rights. And then obviously we've had the Women's Champions League this week with really high quality matches and very exciting matches and lots of drama, which has been, I hate to talk about adverts for the women's game, but you would struggle to find a better advert for the game than those games this week. And then the weekend, the games are staggered so that you could watch every single one if you were so inclined. So there's quite a lot going on this week that's really exciting for the game.
Right. The news is brilliant, not just for the money, but also that there's twice as many games, I think, on Sky, the new broadcast partner, but also a load of games free to air on BBC. But Wednesday night's lineup, then, which you mentioned adverts for the game, Michael Cox describing Barcelona's clash with Man City as the most action-packed game I've seen all season. Isn't that right, Michael?
Yeah, it felt like there was about 20 decent chances, a couple of penalties. It's just really exciting, both sides trying to take the game to each other. And I think the scoreline could have been two goals either way, you know. It could have been various different results, but it's a really good game. And I know the kickoff times were a little bit weird yesterday, and not everyone can spend their whole Wednesday in front of the TV watching the Women's Champions League, but I thought it was really good entertainment from everything I saw.
City were 2-0 down when they had that chance to get back in it with Chloe Kelly's penalty, which the commentator was kind of describing as a turning point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a strange game for City yesterday, because you had, on one hand, they were without Steph Horn, who's a big miss for them, and you had a lot of players who it felt like had slightly off games. I think their defence was just on the rack from the first minute, and Demi Stokes obviously giving away that penalty was very uncharacteristic. But I think that the likes of Ellie Roebuck and Lauren Hemp, who obviously won the penalty, were real shining lights for City. And as Michael was saying, that there were lots of moments of creation despite the scoreline, where realistically City on a good day, I think Ellen White hit the post, it felt like, dozens of times, and drove wide quite a lot, and Chloe Kelly probably not as accurate as she usually is. So I think that it was one of those where on a better day that for City they would have been able to have two or three, but Barcelona were just so far ahead of them in terms of their build-up play, their fluidity, and you know, that's a team that've got plus 96 in the league goal difference. So it was just, I think, amazing for people in the UK who won't watch them week in, week out, or with any kind of regularity, to see the flair and the build-up play in that side, and just how dangerous they can be. And it's been a while, I think. I remember watching them in Champions League finals previously, and they've sort of been put to the sword by Lyon, but to see how impressive they were against City, I think, is going to be quite terrifying for a lot of English teams and a lot of WSL teams that have Champions League aspirations.
Although, three goals down to Barcelona in the first leg, can City do a Liverpool, Katie?
Well, I think it's a really, really big ask, and I think that the biggest fear is that if Barcelona, which you can imagine they will based on yesterday's form, get an early away goal, then you very much feel as though it's game over. I just feel that it's a very, very sizable ask based on Barcelona's form yesterday. I think that there are a lot of players that City are going to have to stop and get the measure of and get better at stopping, and there are a lot of City players that are in turn going to have to up their game. So, I mean, I think, from my perspective, I think if City end up not conceding in the next leg, or it finishes goalless, almost feels like a good result after yesterday. But I don't know. I mean, I'm very much say never, but it just feels a very, very sizable deficit for them to overturn, with the threat that all the while in that game, Barcelona could have the away goal that pushes them out of sight.
Right. And meanwhile, Chelsea have a slender lead in their tie. They're 2-1 up against Wolfsburg. The game's being played, as is traditional, in Hungary, but Chelsea were the designated home side yesterday. 2-1. That Sam Kerr opener. Oh, my word.
He did well with the return pass. Kirby's helped it on. Can Kerr find a finish here around the goalkeeper? Oh, she's done it! Magnificent from Sam Kerr. How on earth has she squeezed that in?
Matt Davis-Adams there with the commentary. What did you think, Katie?
What, the commentary or of the goal?
Sam Kerr's goal, yeah.
When it happened, everyone was a little bit surprised, because Wolfsburg had just been so dominant and were doing all these flips and tricks, and just the way that they were building up, it was just like watching a head tennis game at times with those. There were just so much joy in their build-up play, and then for Chelsea to sort of take it up the other end and steal two goals in really quick succession was just really, really impressive for them. But as for the goal itself, as you were asking, it was just nothing that we haven't seen from Sam Kerr and Frank Kirby this season, but the angle was just so impressive to drag it out in the way that she did, and finish from an angle that was almost flat, to be honest. It was so far out and so far down the right-hand side, but it was a really, really wonderful, composed finish from a really difficult position.
2-1 then, the scoreline heading into the second leg. Lyon, of course, reigning champions once again after beating Wolfsburg in the final last August, defeated Paris Saint-Germain 1-0, and Bayern had a 3-0 win at home to Rosengard. Lyon, Katie, is this going to be the year that someone, maybe an English side, is going to topple them?
Yeah, I mean, it's very tough, because we say every single year, and as long as I've been doing the job, we've been saying it, that Lyon have lost someone this summer, and this is the weakest Lyon side we've seen, or Lyon are a lot weaker on the force that they were last year. And then every single year they prove us wrong, and they just play the most ridiculous football and win by the biggest margins in the final. So it's always something that I'm a bit reluctant to hang my hat on, because they just always seem to find new levels and new depths and things like that. But I suppose from Chelsea's perspective, if we're discounting Manchester City from reaching the final, I think that this is the best Chelsea side, and arguably the best WSL side that we've ever assembled. So I think if they can go all the way, it's just going to be a huge marker for the Women's Super League, because as much as the WSL is the most competitive league, I would say, in Europe, in terms of the number of teams that are there and thereabouts, unlike in France or Germany, for example, where you do have teams running away with it, I think that the biggest test for the WSL sides has always been, can they reach a Champions League final, and can they really impressed and overcome in the last stages of the Champions League? And this feels maybe the most likely for Chelsea, that for a WSL team to do that. So I think it bodes well from that perspective. But obviously, this is the first real test that they've had from a European competition and European opponents to see just how far that they have come, because they're brushing aside people in the WSL every week without fail, and you can almost set your watch by another Chelsea row each week. But can they do that on the European stage, and can they do that against the very best European sides? I think that yesterday's game against Wolfsburg was a real good omen, and now it's seeing whether they can carry that on.
Brilliant. All right, Katie, thank you so much for being with us. Of course, all your coverage of the WCL and WSL and the women's game available at theathletic.com. Second legs of those games coming up next week, and it is delicately poised, isn't it, that Chelsea-Wolfsburg one, Michael?
Yeah, I'm a bit more negative than Katie about Chelsea's performance and their likelihood of triumphing. I didn't think they played well yesterday. I mean, the second goal they scored was a complete giveaway from the Wolfsburg goalkeeper when they're playing out. And I just wonder whether they might have to play a little bit more cautiously in upcoming games. Emma Hayes has played three outright forwards, and I think sometimes they've found themselves a bit understaffed in midfield. I think someone like Erin Cuthbert, who's played really well in the big games, particularly at home to Manchester City earlier this season, she came on later, and I thought it just kind of made Chelsea a little bit more solid. And I wonder whether they'll just need to be a bit more tactically astute to get through some of these games, because I thought really Wolfsburg could have been 2 or 3-0 up by half time, and we would have been talking about this in a very different way.
All right. Well, second leg's coming up next week. Now, to conclude today's show, yes, it's the Intertotally Cup first round.
The Inter Totally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy's offers are at full capacity. Get a free bet if one leg of your 4-plus fold ACCA lets you down on all football matches and markets.
T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
So, it's back. After last year's triumph, we've got a brand new Inter Totally tournament beginning today. 16 of your Totally favourites will be facing off for the ultimate prize in in-house bragging rights. Today, it's round one, Coxie v Williams, and a clash move to the Puskás Stadium in Budapest due to COVID restrictions. Let's meet our contestant.
Up first, representing the Principality of Wales, he is the man of 1,000 footballing tongues. Oh boy, oh boy, oh, Tom Williams.
Tom Williams. Eliminated at this stage last year after a tiebreaker with James Horncastle. How are you feeling?
Yeah, good. Happy to be back in this prestigious competition. Still smarting somewhat from last year's defeat at the hands of a frankly corrupt tiebreak system. So hoping to right some wrongs, James.
I see. Now, a novelty this year is that the winner of each match will be earning £10 for the charity of their choice, which Paddy Power will then place on a bet, also of your choosing, with the winnings also going to charity. Who will your nominated charity be, Tom?
So my charity is the Music Venue Trust, which is a British charity that supports grassroots music venues in the UK. So they were already doing some important work before the pandemic, and doubly so now with so many live music venues facing financial difficulties.
Absolutely. All right, well, now time to meet your opponent. One more time.
And his opponent, he is our reigning, defending, undisputed, universal heavyweight champion from the mean streets of Surbiton, Michael Cox.
Sending a bit of a message there with his choice of entrance music, Michael Cox, the reigning champion. Michael, you're clearly in confident mood.
Yeah, relatively speaking, but a difficult first round draw. I actually fully agree with Tom about last year's tiebreaker. So, this could be a difficult game.
Could be. And a worrying form coming into this with that pre-tournament slip-up at the Opta's for you.
I won. What are you joking?
Did you win? No. I thought you came second.
Well, individually,
it's about the team, James. It's about the 3 points. So
not today, it's not, Michael. Not today.
Oh no, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
What's your charity of choice, Michael?
I'm doing it for Sparkle Malawi, which is a charity that helps orphans in Malawi. They have links with Kingstonian, and one of our former players is running and cycling a ludicrous amount in support of them. So the least I can do is sit on my backside and answer questions about football to help out.
Mm. Is it tougher? I don't know. Not for me to say. Duncan, what do you think?
Well, I've crunched the numbers and, yeah, it's a tough task for Tom. But, you know, Wales have occasionally shown they can pull a result out of the bag. Let's just hope he doesn't pull Bowden over the bar on the last question.
We shall see. Now, this year, the opening series of contests will only feature general knowledge questions. The specialist subjects will be returning later on. And with that in mind...
General football knowledge, right?
General football knowledge, yes.
Phew!
So, if you're ready, Tom, let's begin with your questions. Question one. Joey Barton left Fleetwood Town earlier this year, but was appointed manager of which EFL club a few weeks later?
Rotherham.
I'm afraid not. Michael, can you help him?
Bristol Rovers?
It was Bristol Rovers. Ooh, psychological blow there early on. Question two, Tom. At which club is Alan Pardew currently technical director?
Oh, he left that club in Holland, didn't he? But where is he now?
Totally. Listeners are all over this because they've heard us discussing it at length in our Euro edition, or possibly the other ones. Have you got an answer for us, Tom?
Somewhere random, isn't it? No, I don't know. Pass.
Again, Michael, can you help, Tom?
I'm not sure. Is it? Is someone like Levski Sofia? Is it them?
Oh, he's so close. It was Cesca Sofia. Cesca Sofia. Right. Okay. 0-2 so far then. On to question three. Sam Allardyce has taken charge of 8 different Premier League clubs. His longest spell was at Bolton. But which club would be second longest on that list? Sam Allardyce's second longest spell at a Premier League club.
I'm going to say West Ham.
Is correct. Boom. He's on the scoreboard. Question four. Name the club, Tom, from this list of their shirt sponsors in the 1990s, 2000s. NEC, Danker, Everton. 121. Everton is the correct answer. Well in. And question five. Which England player missed a penalty in their shootout win over Colombia at the 2018 World Cup? So penalty shootout with Colombia, 2018 World Cup. Who was the England player that missed the penalty?
That is not ringing any bells. I mean, I watched
Paul Bowden analogy is working quite well here.
Yeah. John Stones?
It was not John Stones. Michael?
I think it was Henderson.
It was Henderson. So at the end of your round, Tom, you scored 2 out of 5. How'd you feel?
Disappointed. Yeah.
Okay.
I did actually do some swatting up and none of it helped in any way whatsoever. So yeah, that was an afternoon well spent yesterday.
Well, with a score of 2 out of 5 to beat, let's bring on Michael Cox. Michael, if you're ready, your first question. Which EFL club sacked Harry Kewell earlier this month?
I'm terrible with EFL questions. I'm not sure it was them.
But?
I think Crawley?
Is wrong! Wow. Reigning champion off to a shaky start. The correct answer was Oldham Athletic. Question two. Which Eredivisie team did Alan Pardew manage last season?
Was it Ve?
No. Oh my word.
I think I know this one.
Go on, Tom.
Was it ADO Den Haag?
It was. Well googled. Question three.
That is knowledge, James.
Oh dear. Question three. Who is the only current Premier League manager to have won the FA Cup as both a player and a manager?
So the only current Premier League player who's won the FA Cup as a player.
The only current Premier League manager to have won the FA Cup as both a player and a manager.
Arteta.
Is correct. Question four. This to Paul Level with Tom Williams. Name the club from this list of their shirt sponsors in the 1990s, 2000s. Müller, AST, LDV Vans, NTL.
Aston Villa.
Is correct. So it's all tied on two answers apiece going into Michael's final question, which is this. Question five. Who scored Croatia's goals in the 2018 World Cup final?
One was Mandzukic, and I think the other was Perisic.
Is that your answer, Michael?
Yeah.
Then you're going through to the quarterfinals of this year's Intertotally Cup.
Heartbreak.
But it was tie. Oh, Tom, how do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, gutting to miss out in such dramatic circumstances. And like Michael, kicking myself for literally not paying any attention to anything that happens below the Premier League.
Mm. Michael, that was unexpectedly tight after Tom's wobbles.
Yeah, difficult one. Difficult one. Yeah, EFL questions always trip me up. But
all right, well, that's something maybe to work on ahead
you're
of
saying,
your quarter
you're saying 2-0 is a hard lead to overcome, Michael? Just the record.
When's the round on like European Cup winners and World Cup winners, things like that? Is that coming up?
Well, for those still in the competition, they can choose a specialist subject later on. But we'll have more, of course, more first round drama on Monday when it'll be Daniel Storey up against Sasha Gurionov. Wow. So any questions on stadiums and their proximity to Napoleonic battlegrounds? We'll be right in Sasha's wheelhouse. Very good. Okay. There you go. That brings us to the end then of today's Totally Football show. Many, many thanks to Tom, to Duncan and to Michael. Any final thoughts before we let everyone head off for a weekend of sunny international football?
Only that I've got 4 out of 5 on both rounds in my head. It's very easy when it's not the spotlight's not beating down on your own head. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wise words.
Existential. Right,
yeah, he's banging them in training, isn't he? Yeah.
He's looked great in the nets.
Duncan, you'll get your chance to see if you can do it under big game conditions when you have your first round clash with a debutant in the Intertotally, Adrian Clark. Woo!
Oof. Football League expert. I better get football leaguing.
You had. All right, then. Many thanks again to everybody and you, listener, and have a great weekend. And we'll catch up with you early doors Monday. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.